Welcome to Queer Writers of Crime, featuring interviews with renowned LGBTQ authors and up-and-coming talent in mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine is here to give her weekly recommendation. I want to start off by thanking everybody that joined us for Queer Noir at the Bar last week. It was a lot of fun. I hope you enjoyed it. And I don't know the exact dollar figure, but we did raise some good money for Lambda Literary.
We'll have the dollar figure next week, or are they keeping that secret?
No, they don't keep a secret. I just didn't happen to get it. I just didn't look it up in time.
All right, so we'll share it next week.
Yes. And then there's something I'm going to add that I hope listeners will like. I am going to start announcing every week some of the upcoming guests. So if you'd like to leave a question that you would like to ask that guest, you will have the opportunity to do so.
Well, that's a great idea. Why don't we come up with that sooner?
We didn't have the voicemail option that was so easy before.
Okay, good.
So you just go to the website and there's a microphone. And I'll probably put in a webpage too that will list who's coming up. Now, these aren't necessarily in the exact order because sometimes that changes, but I can tell them who we have coming up. So let's see. People coming up are Wendy Hurd, J.B. Saunders, Bill Prystock, and of course, Michael Nava.
That's wonderful.
We have a good mix of people and some mystery, some suspense, and even a kinky thriller in there.
Ooh, that sounds like fun.
Yes, it does. I'm steaming up just thinking about it.
I think I'm going to submit a question for J.B. Saunders.
Okay, that's fine. So just go to the website. There's a little button there to hit the microphone and leave a message. And if you're timid and don't want to use the microphone, it's okay if you use the contact page. But we'd like to be able to use your voice on the show. Either way, it's up to you.
Yeah. Always give people a break from our voices.
Yes. So, Justine, I extended your segment, and then today you tell me you don't have a book recommendation. So are we going to spend 15 minutes just hearing you hum?
No. I'm gonna share why I don't have a book recommendation, but I am going to share a few books by people who have been guests on our show before now that have books that have been recently released, and I think our listeners will enjoy them. So, which do you want to do first?
Let's do the new books that are coming out.
Okay. Olivier Bosman just released a book on February 9th. It's called A Little More Morbid. It is the second of his John Billings mysteries. The first series with John Billings, set in Victorian England. He was a cop in those mysteries. And at the end of that series, he was drummed out of the police force for being gay, but they kept it all hush-hush. They just asked him to leave. And in this new series, he is setting up a private investigation service. The book is, and I know you don't like this with the series, but this book is the second book in the series, and you really, really need to read the first, because some of this is not going to make sense without the first. And the mystery, while it's the first one ends on a solve for now, not necessarily a happy for now, but a solve for now, then loose ends from that first book are developed, and some of them are solved in this second book.
I'm okay with that as long as you know in advance.
Right. So pick up the John Billings mystery, pick up book one if you haven't read it, and then almost immediately I recommend you go on to book two. They really are very good, very well done. And the John Billings character is not so likable, but he really... You get to know him, and he's really complex and an interesting person. I'm not sure I'd want to hang out with him, but I do like to read about him.
And who else do you have?
Well, Dieter Moitzi. I've forgotten already how to pronounce his last name. He's been a guest before. Olivier's been a guest before, and Dieter's been a guest before. He's did the Stuffed Coffin, which I recommended, and that was the first in a series. But as he said when you interviewed him later, that he's got a number of books that are all the start of a series, and this one is either a standalone or a start of a different series. It's called An Ordinary Whore, and it is a mystery. It is a literary mystery, and the main character is his father dies at the beginning, and he gets thrust into situation, shall we say.
And it's an ordinary whore?
An ordinary whore.
I love the title, though. I would not be happy if I got an ordinary whore.
Oh, God. You know, sometimes you're in the mood for ordinary.
Sometimes,
and, you know, it's like, I remember a sitcom where one of the characters said, no new stuff. Let's just do the same old stuff. Okay.
And it's like,
I don't want any new stuff.
Sometimes it's like 2 a.m. at the bar. You take what you can get.
Right. Exactly. Okay. Or sometimes other people are taking what they can get and end up with you.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Well, I was really thinking more of me in my younger days, you know.
Okay.
But you know how that is. And my daughter often says, what if you're a supporting character in your own life movie?
Interesting to think about.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. The next book I'm recommending, Meg Perry, who has been on the show. Her Jamie Brody mysteries have been very wonderful. Jamie is a librarian, UCLA librarian, who uses his research skills to solve mysteries. He's married to a former cop, but his brother's a current cop. So his brother and his husband were partners once when on the police force. His brother stays on the police force, and his husband has gone on to teach psychology. They have solved a lot of mysteries, and we are up to book 21. But book 21 is the final in a series, and I'm going to be sorry to see them go.
And what's the title of it?
Resigned to Death. And I think it's not only a pun on I'm resigning myself to this, but also he resigns as a librarian in this book. So, and it's the end of an era.
Yeah. We discussed that.
That's right. Okay. And so the last book I'm recommending is by Tal Bauer. He was on our show very early on. And his episode is still one of our most listened to episodes. So while this book is called a romantic suspense novel, and it's heavy on the romance, since he has been listened to so often, I am sure that some of our listeners are eager to get their hands on this next book.
You're bending the rules.
I know.
That's okay.
I'm bending the rules.
That's okay.
I'm bending the rules, but, you know, and he was on for his earlier books. But he really is one of our most listened to shows.
Yes,
so
he is.
This book is called The Murder Between Us.
I know he's extremely popular.
He is.
Obviously by the number of listens he's had.
That's right. And by the number of books he sells.
That is true.
Yeah. Okay, so those are the books. They're all on my TBR pile. I got an early copy of A Little Bit Mormon, so that's why I can tell you for sure that's a great book and that you need to read the first one.
What else do you have for us? You've got quite a bit of time left.
I do have quite a bit of time left. Well, let me just say that one of the reasons why I have fallen behind in my pleasure reading is we've got a heavy schedule for Requeered Tales this year. We took a bit of a break, and I am deep into proofreading our next several releases. We've got Stan Leventhal's book, Skydiving on Christopher Street, which is the follow-up to his earlier book, Mountain Climbing in Sheridan Square. So it is out on pre-order. It is going to be released on February 23rd. And he lives in the village at probably the height of the AIDS era, but at a time when Greenwich Village has been returned, the gays have taken over the neighborhood, really.
As gays do.
As gays do, but, you know, they were kind of, you know, underground. And then after the Stonewall riots, that became the one of the centers in the country for gay life. And he is very much a part of it. The neighborhood is very much a part of it. He's an editor at a Poured magazine, which sounds all very exciting, but it's really just another job. And with all the hassles of deadlines and bosses who have ridiculous demands and annoying coworkers, at some point he realizes that he is positive and has to deal with the after effects of dealing with that, the side effects, and facing his own mortality. And it's not a mystery, but if you like literary fiction, and Stan Leventhal is one of the greats. So I'm not sure our listeners are really familiar with what Requeered Tales does.
We talk about it every week.
It's like I say Requeered Tales is out with this, Requeered Tales is out with that. Requeered Tales is devoted to bringing back classic gay fiction, which was published, our general time frame is after Stonewall and to the turn of the century. We have some books that were published in the early 2000s, but mostly it's between Stonewall and the turn of the century. We have a large number of mystery series, which are very well beloved. We formed this at some point as an idea where somebody says, wouldn't it be great if people republish those books that we all were familiar with? Books that you can only get a used copy of for often more than you'd like to pay for a single book. So we started looking around, and there's, you know how like some people when they're looking back and they talk about how they met and everybody's got a different version?
Yes.
So some of us, well, mostly me, think that the publishing label was started with Grant Michaels. Grant Michaels does those marvelous series. He's still one of our best-selling authors, the Stan Krajicek series. And we are republishing the last of his books, and then after that, we're going to have a surprise.
Ooh.
Now, other people, everybody who's not me, think we started with John Morgan Wilson. John Morgan Wilson was talking about getting his books back into print, and we were talking about helping him. And by the time we got around to really finalizing those discussions, we had turned it into a full-fledged publishing house.
My memory ain't worth a shit. I think it was Grant Michaels.
Yeah, well, see, there you go. You and I are on the same track. One more vote for me.
I'm on your side.
But John Morgan Wilson, he's the Lambda Award-winning author of the Benjamin Justice series, and he is rewriting his books before they come out. So we've only republished the first one, which was very much revised and much better than the first one, which won the Edgar Award for Best New Novel. So if you can imagine how good it has to be win the Edgar Award, which is, you know, the Mystery Writers of America's award system, and now it's improved. So people really picked that one up. And now he's working on rewriting the second one. So, you know, every time he opens up, he thinks, oh, this will be a quick polish. And then he gets into it, and he's very much a perfectionist, very wedded to his craft, and he has rewritten this one extensively also.
And for those that don't know, generally speaking, within the mystery writing field, the Edgar is the award to get. It's the highest honor.
That's exactly right. Yes. It's the equivalent of a Grammy or a Tony in the mystery world. And I believe he was the first gay novel to receive an award from that organization. We have a lot of other mystery series coming out this year. We are in the middle of publishing two lesbian mystery series. The Nikki Baker series, and she writes about Virginia Kelly, who was a financier. We have published the first two books, and we're going to be publishing more of that series. Lauren Wright Douglas also has written a mystery series, Caitlin Reese Mysteries. We published the first one, Always Anonymous Beasts, and we're going to be publishing more from her in the next few months. And then we've got other literary things. We've got the science fiction novel by Felice Picano. It republishes his first book, Dryland's End, which was planned to be the first in a series, and the rest of the series is finished, and they are going to be newly published by Requeered Tales. So those of you who are fans of his Dryland's End book will finally get to read the rest of the series.
I generally don't like saying I'm not a fan of a particular genre, because I like a good book regardless of the genre, but science fiction is probably one of the last ones I would pick up. But written by Felice Picano.
Yeah, you're going to pick it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we've got an exciting year ahead, but I am deep into proofreading. I've got some hard editing to do on the newer books. So every now and then I don't get time to read a mystery.
You're forgiven.
Okay. But people have four books to check out this week, all of which I recommend mainly on the quality of their authors.
Well, the four books that you're recommending, and then anything from Requeered Tales, every single week, there's a link in the show notes to Recruit Tales. So just click that button and look at all they've done. You guys have done a great job.
Thanks. We really appreciate it. It's been a labor of love. Yes.
So once again, to remind people, if you want to ask a question of upcoming authors, Wendy Hurd, J.B. Sanders, Bill Priestek, and Michael Nava are coming up. So leave a recording or at least send a comment.
Great.
I'll see you next week.
I will see you next week.
Hi, this is Brad. Not only do I interview authors, I write novels too. Check out my Mitchell Riley mystery series on my website, bradshreve.com. My guest, Rick R. Reed, is an award-winning and best-selling author of more than 50 works of published fiction. He is a Lambda Literary Award finalist. Entertainment Weekly has described his work as heartrending and sensitive. Lambda Literary has called him a writer that doesn't disappoint. You can find him at his blog, which is in the show notes. And Rick lives in Palm Springs, California, with his husband, Bruce, and their two rescue dogs, Cody and Joaquin. Welcome to Queer Writers of Crime, Rick.
Thanks, Brad. I'm so happy to be here on a sunny Sunday afternoon.
So you've written over 40 books.
Yes. Somehow I don't know how I did that, but it's a curse and a blessing. I'm blessed with more ideas than I'll probably ever live long enough to write. So as much as I dream of retiring and maybe walking away, I don't think that'll ever happen because there are just too many stories to be told. So I'm fortunate that I have some people that like to read what I write. And so I will continue, and that number will grow, and maybe at 50 I'll.
I gotta say, I'm like you, because I'm surprised when people say, I want to write a book, but I can't come up with any ideas. And I'm like, that's the last problem I have. Like you, I'll never be able to write the books for all the ideas that are swirling in my brain.
Exactly. And I think the more you write and the more you discipline yourself to sit at a computer or an open notebook or whatever you use, whatever tool you use to write with, the more ideas that come to you. And I also think if you are open to, I think it's my opinion, all good writers are also readers. And I think the more stuff you read, the more inspired you get. And you, I'm not saying you copy other authors, but you get inspired by what they do, and you might want to, it causes more ideas to come. And so that's why there's just never a shortage of things that I want to talk about. So.
And I agree with you about reading. I had Lev Raphael as a guest, and I mentioned to him that I feel guilty when I'm reading because I should be writing. And his response was excellent. He said, Brad, reading is writing.
I agree with that. That's absolutely the truth. And I think I've thought since I was a kid that you learn so much about writing through reading, and it might not be a conscious learning, but almost subconsciously or through osmosis, you're taking in technique, you're taking in how stories are told, how characters come alive or they don't, you know, all these things kind of, I don't think there's a better classroom for a writer than reading books.
I would agree with you 100% there as well. And one thing I found, I went through a period where I wasn't reading as much and my vocabulary went down.
And so how did you notice that? Did you find yourself pointing to things?
I don't know what it was. I think when I started reading again, it picked up that I hadn't been using some words that I was reading. I don't know how I realized that. That's a good question, but I did notice it. Nobody pointed out and said, Brad, you talk like a fool, but... Well, actually, they say that all the time, but that's a whole different story.
That has nothing to do with your vocabulary. I've always been a reader. There's never been a time that I haven't been. I mean, since I was a small child, I always have been reading. It's just one of my passions in my whole life. When I finish something, there's something, the next thing to move on to. And often, you know, they're overlapping and I'm starting something before I finish the last book. And yeah, I live in a world of my imagination.
Since you brought it up, when you mentioned that you started at a very early age of writing, let's talk about reading. What were the earliest books that you remember reading that hooked you?
Like as a child?
Yes, as a child.
Okay. I will go with the child books that I really loved. And the ones that first spring to mind are the Wizard of Oz series. Mm-hmm. I just love those. They're very different from the movie. And a lot, they're much more, the world building is much more expansive. You know, I don't know exactly how many books are in the series, but I want to say something like a dozen. And I just love those books. And, you know, I can remember just kind of disappearing into that world because it wasn't a dream in the books. Oz was a real place. And I think, you know, those books and the movie itself too. And I grew up in a time when it was a really special event when the movie came on TV because it was the only way you could see it. I think that's one of those things that's worked its way into my artistic consciousness. And I think, you know, themes about home and escaping, they're present in my own fiction. So those books come to mind. I read like Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys too when I was a little kid, but I actually read a lot of things I shouldn't have. My parents didn't really police my reading choices. So, I mean, for example, I remember reading Ira Levin's Rosemary's Baby when I was in third grade.
Oh, my.
Which there's no way I should have been reading that, but I did. And, you know, I'd go to the library every Saturday and my mom would be like, just go pick out what you want. And I would pick, you know, five or six books and the limit that you could take out. And I was usually in the adult section, so I was a precocious reader. But as I grew, people like, I think Stephen King was a big influence in my kind of teen years. I kind of started reading him right along with when he started getting published. I started with Carrie, which was his first book, and I've read almost everything he's written. And I think he's maybe comparable to Charles Dickens or something for our time. He once referred to himself as literary McDonald's, but he's much better than that. And he's written some things that are much, much better than just kind of fast food fiction.
Yeah, I can think of other authors that would follow under literary McDonald's, but definitely not Stephen King.
And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I love escapist fiction, and it doesn't have to be anything more than something that, as long as it grabs my attention and holds it, it doesn't have to be great literature, although great literature is wonderful. But the worst crime a book or a movie or anything can commit, in my opinion, is bore me. I don't want to be bored. And if you bore me and it's work to get through what you're writing or what you're filming, then you probably have failed me as a recipient of your art.
You remind me of, I used to live in Greensboro, North Carolina, which is where Orson Scott Card lives. And he wrote an editorial for the local paper. And it pretty much said, if your kids are reading comic books or reading books that you don't feel like they should, it's just brain candy, get off their case and let them read. Storytelling has evolved in different ways throughout our whole history.
Yes.
As long as they're reading, you should be happy.
I totally agree with that. And if I were ever a teacher, what I would be trying to do is introduce students to, you know, what makes great art when it comes to books. But also I want to introduce them to things that they would get passionate about and that they would be really engaged in. And you saying comics reminded me of, you asked what I read as a child, and I used to read the Archie comic books all the time. I used to read Mad Magazine all the time. You know, as I got a little older, I read National Lampoon. Those things, you know, art in the Smithsonian or anything, but they did contribute to, I'm sure they contributed to my humor, my sense of storytelling and how you pace a story and how characters work. I just don't think you can harm yourself by whatever it is you choose to read. It's going to help you.
I agree with you. It's funny you mentioned Mad Magazine. For whatever reason, yesterday I was thinking of the little comic they had called Spy versus Spy. I don't know why that came to my head. Back to Oz, though. I think that would be a really good book at an early age because you have world building, which is huge with the Oz books. And there's also a lot of different emotions. Mm-hmm. So I would think that you would have learned a lot from that.
Oh, yeah. And it has popped up. I mean, kind of specifically in my fiction, I know there's I think more than once, but there's a scene in my second novel, which is called Penance, which is about street kids in Chicago. It's very dark, and it's about a pedophile that preys on them and keeps them prisoner in his basement. And so it's very dark, but there's a scene in it that is parallel to the scene where Dorothy is in the movie is trapped in the witch's castle and she thinks she sees Auntie M in the big crystal ball that the witch has. And I echoed that in a scene in Penance where one of the kids who's being held captive kind of relives that scene.
Since you brought up Penance, I'm going to go back to your earliest books, which were your first published novel that I'm aware of. Was it Obsessed in 91?
Yes.
And then Penance was in 92. And those were dark horror novels.
Yes, they were part of a line of horror that Dell put out, edited by Jean Cavellos, who's a wonderful editor. And she kind of developed and made the line what it was, which was really kind of cutting edge horror. And she found a lot of people that introduced the world to a lot of people, not just me, but like Kathy Koja and Poppy Z. Bright, who's now Billy Martin, and who else? Ron D., Brian Hodge. It was just Dennis Etchison, I think, wrote something for them. And I was so proud to be that's where my writing career kind of began. And so it's the unfortunate thing was the line ended fairly after just a couple of years because Jean decided to pursue other interests and she was really the driving force behind the line.
There's a couple of big gaps in your writing career because Penance was in 92 and I believe the next book was not until 2000, which is A Face Without a Heart.
Wow, you've done your research.
Well, I'll tell you, it wasn't easy because I could tell on Amazon a lot of your books have been republished. So the dates were very confusing to me. So I had to dig a little deeper to find out this information. But there was an 8-year gap there.
Yeah. And, it was partially life, partially, I started out not as a gay fiction writer, but as a horror author. And I kind of, that market, and at the time I got Obsessed and Penance published, you know, I had a New York agent and things were going really very well when we sold Obsessed and when Penance came along. But then the horror market sort of took a nosedive for a little while in the early 90s. And it was getting harder and harder to sell things. And also I was going through a lot of things personally that I wasn't actually writing things. And so, yeah, that was the 8-year gap there. And then Face Without a Heart, which is a modern day version of Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray. It was actually the idea to write an updated version of that came from my agent at the time, Lori Perkins. And I wrote the book and ended up getting frustrated with her because she wasn't sending it out. And I sent it out myself and a small press published it and did a beautiful job. It's the original Face Without a Heart is a beautiful book. It's illustrated and with very edgy, beautiful black and white photos. And then, you know, life got in the way for several years. And it wasn't until well, you probably know all this, but, you know, 2007, I really came back to writing. And then by then, I was really focused on gay fiction and horror and romance, which are two sides, I think, of the same coin. They have a lot more in common. People, when I tell people I write love stories and I write horror stories or I write suspense and romance, they're kind of surprised because they seem at such odds with each other, but they're not. They're both engaging. They're both very universal, have very universal appeal to people because of what they are about at their bottom line, and that is, you know, love. And I think most horror is rooted in death. So, you know, our greatest need and hope is, you know, probably love, and our greatest fear is death, especially an ugly death. So those things, and they also are very physically, they both cause a very strong reaction to our heart rate, our breathing, our, you know, all those things. Both those kinds of stories do the same thing, but for different reasons.
So in 2007, you wrote a couple of horror books, but that's when things really took off for you.
Yes.
And have continued. What changed to make that happen?
I think, I think partially it was the publishing world started to change in 2007. And it was a little easier for small presses to, sustain themselves. And before that time, the notion of print on demand, which is where, you know, people can order books, and rather than having in the past, like when Obsessed was published, it had a huge print run because there was no print on demand. There was no Amazon. There was none of this kind of online world. So I think Obsessed had something like 100,000 print run, and it was everywhere. And it was, it's still my best-selling book because of that world. But by 2007, when I Am was published, there was print on demand. Ebooks were just kind of getting started, but there was a lot more, the market was much more open for writers, and more diverse voices could be heard. And I could write more freely about what we call own voices, which are just, it's people, members of marginalized communities writing their stories. And it's not exclusive. I saw something earlier where someone was talking about own voices, like it was trying to, the whole concept of that was trying to be a gate or a wall against people writing about, you know, anything outside their realm of personal experience. And that's not it. It's just that the people that are part of, you know, whatever they are, whether it's gay or Asian or African-American or Native American, the people that are those things have a certain level of authority that they can tell their stories. That doesn't mean other people can't tell those stories without the right research, because we all have, most of us have much more in common than we do differences. I've written, for example, you know, a love story about lesbians, and I'm not female, I'm not a lesbian, but the elements of falling in love, the desires that you have, the physical desires, the emotional desires, those are human concepts. They're not exclusive to gender. But anyway, I'm kind of rambling here, so
you're rambling interesting stuff. That's why I haven't stopped you.
Well, good.
The lesbian novels that you brought up, I think it was a two-part series. Is that correct?
Well, what I'm thinking of is a book that came out right after Obsessed. Not Obsessed, but after I Am, which was my internet stalker killer story that came out in 2007. But right after that was a vampire novel called In the Blood, which featured a lesbian couple. It also had a gay couple. It was a trio of vampires, and the woman was a lesbian and who falls in love with this streetwalker, who's also an artist. And it disrupts the trio that she's with, which is a straight male vampire and a gay male vampire. And the gay male vampire is the youngest of them all. And his story kind of parallels what might be happening to the streetwalkers. So that story is definitely a predominantly lesbian romance at the heart of it. Because, well, I don't want to give spoilers, but it really reinforces what you're willing to give up for love.
With you writing lesbian novels, do you think the fact that you did add two gay male characters, do you think that prevented any kind of backlash you may have received, or how was the book received?
You know, it's a book. It's one of my, I guess, one of my books that I'm proudest of, and I hate to admit this, but it's also one of the books that's been probably the hardest to sell. And maybe it's just because there isn't, you know, it's not clearly gay male, it's not clearly lesbian, it's not clearly straight. It did well when it was titled In the Blood first, in the first edition. And actually, there's a lesbian, a very prominent lesbian group that does awards every year called the Golden Crown Literary Society. And they nominated In the Blood as best horror novel for that year, and it was a finalist. And I went to their convention in Atlanta that year, which was one of the most memorable times of my life, because I was one of only, I think there were maybe 250 people there. I was one of only three men. So I wasn't really sure how I was going to be received, how welcome I would be, but it was surprising how I was really welcomed into the fold. And I had a wonderful time. I didn't win the award, but it was, as everyone says, it was an honor to be nominated. And so I don't know what my point was with that, but
I think your point was that you were welcomed.
Oh, and you were asking how that book was received. And I just wanted to say that it was republished a couple years ago as, good Lord, I lose my own titles here. What was it? It was, I'm looking at my bookcase. Oh, well, I'm trying to think of what I renamed it, but all that's coming to mind is there's going to be one more. I'm going to give one more try to this book. Nine Star Press is publishing it later this year, and the new title is Immortal Things. And hopefully it will get the eyes of more readers, because I really think it's a great book. It's a, if I may say so, It tells the story of these trio of art-loving lesbians, not lesbians, vampires, who kind of live to appreciate art and collect art. And when they find this streetwalker who's an artist, they recognize her genius, and the woman vampire falls in love with her. But it's really about immortality and art, and how becoming a vampire is in the book means you give up your creativity as part of the bargain you make to have immortal life. And so that's sort of the driving conflict. Will this artist who falls in love with this lesbian vampire, will she let herself be turned? Because the cost of that is losing her creativity. But in exchange for it, she can have immortal life with this woman that she loves. And so how that plays out is the story. And it's also the parallel story of the young male vampire who is kind of has an unrequited love for the straight male vampire, and how they met in 1950s New York City in the expressionist art scene there at that time. There's so many things I love about that book that I hope more people will embrace it, because it's probably one of my least read books. And I'm not sure why, because vampires are kind of used a lot, but it's still a very popular trope for fiction.
Yeah, they don't ever seem to go out of style.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting that in the novel they have to give up their creativity, because that sounds like an extremely creative novel.
Yeah, well, I hope, as I said, I hope that it, this latest edition, which I think comes out in July or August. It's this summer. I think, you know, it'll be re-edited and it has a new title and it'll have, I'm sure, a great new cover and everything. And I think it'll, you know, hopefully it will get some more eyes.
Get it over to me when you get it and I'll put it on my social media for you.
Oh, okay. I'll hold you to it.
I'm going to fast forward a bit because I want to talk about a novel that you wrote that I am absolutely fascinated with. And you published it last July, The Man from Milwaukee.
Yes. My Jeffrey Dahmer book.
Yes. Tell us about that story.
The Man from Milwaukee takes place in the summer of 1991, mostly. And it's Jeffrey Dahmer was arrested in 1991. So it opens on a scene of this very closeted young man, Emory Hughes, on the L train on his way home from this dead-end job in Chicago, reading about Dahmer. And he feels a kind of peculiar affinity with him. Like, he feels that he has this unique understanding of him. And it's, you see into his life, which is pretty sad. He has a mother. This contributes to, I think, his self-loathing of himself as a gay man, which he doesn't accept at the beginning of the book. His mother is dying from AIDS, which she had gotten through a blood transfusion. In 1991, you know, it was pretty much a death sentence. He lives with a sister who doesn't contribute to caring for the mother at all. So it's all left up to him. And he goes to work every day, this kind of soul-sucking, mindless job. He comes home at night. He has to take care of this mother who's suffering from dementia and wasting away. And this Dahmer bursts into his life and he begins writing to him in prison. And they...
Don't give too much.
I don't want to give too much away. There is a correspondence and there's also, Emory begins to explore his life as a gay man and begins to come to accept that through the attraction and love he starts to feel for a young coworker who's sort of the other side of Emory. He's a young gay man just out of college. He's very accepting. He's very happy. He's well-adjusted. He's everything Emory's not. And so they make a very odd pairing. And so the story kind of, when I was starting out, I thought it was going to be pretty much a horror story, a dark, ugly story about maybe, you know, Emory becoming a killer who followed in Dahmer's footsteps. And there is some hint of that perhaps happening. But I think ultimately, and maybe it's just because I'm older and wiser, hopefully, the story becomes more a tale of redemption and how love can really transform someone and maybe make a significant change in someone's life. So I think that's obtuse enough not to be a spoiler, but I'm really proud of the book. And it's interesting as a writer how what my intentions were at the beginning wasn't exactly where it ended up. But I think it ended up in the right place.
You know, we hear about stories of people that through letters do fall in love with mass killers. Mm-hmm. We know that happens. But I'm going to ask a question that I generally don't ask people because most authors, it drives us crazy when we're asked this. But for this particular novel, where did the idea come from? Because to me, it's amazing.
Well, I do remember that time, and I was very fascinated by Jeffrey Dahmer. And in some of the pictures of him, if you look at him and get the right photograph, he looks pretty cute. And I lived in Chicago back then when he was in Milwaukee and using... But he would come to Chicago. He would go to Carol's Speakeasy in Old Town in Chicago. He would go to different bars. And I think probably a lot of the idea came from the fact that if I ran into him at a bar, I might have gone home with him. And that's really chilling to think that. And I've mentioned that to other gay men who are old enough to kind of remember when this was all going down in 91. And they said the same thing, that they might have gone home with him as well. And it's a creepy thing because, you know, nobody expects to encounter horror like he engendered in the world. So I think that was part of the inspiration. And part of the inspiration, too, was about I, as a gay man, came out late. I was married to a woman for 7 years and had a son, and really tried very hard to be what I thought the world wanted me to be, what I thought my family wanted me to be, and hating myself, really, which is why nothing makes me angrier than people saying that being gay is a choice. It's not, because I fought so hard against it through my teens and through my 20s. And really, the face I showed to the world was a mask. And I think what comes through in The Man from Milwaukee was, here's someone who hated himself. The main character hated himself so much that he could identify with a serial killer, because what he identified was having impulses that were out of control. And that's what he writes to him in his first letter, that he understands him, and that probably no one else does, because he knows what it's like to have these impulses that you don't want to have, and you try to force it down and they won't go away. And he projects that onto Dahmer. So that's kind of the twin points of my inspiration for the book.
I want to go back to what you talked about, your marriage, and I'm not going to ask for details on your life at the time, but I have a connection with you. You came out at 30, I believe. Mm-hmm. I came out at 35. I have a daughter. You have a son as a result.
Yes.
You don't have to give me the details of what happened when you came out, but I would like to know the feelings when you finally took that step.
It was a tumultuous, very difficult time. My son was 6 years old, and you know, when we separated, I love the woman I married. I won't say that, you know, it was some devious plot on my part to deceive or anything. I really loved her, and I really wanted things to work, and I really thought they would. I really thought, okay, once I get married, you know, these feelings I have that I'm trying to push away, they'll go away, because I'll just be a married man. And then when we had a son, and, you know, I thought everything would be fine. But it seemed the harder I tried to push the feelings away, the stronger they became. And I saw a couple different therapists to try to change, and it just wasn't possible. And I only found a sort of realistic happiness when I sort of gave up the fight, when I sort of had to lay down the sword and the shield and say, no, I can't fight this. This is who I am. And if anyone's going to love me for who I am and not for some idea that they have of me, then I have to be honest to myself first, and then I have to be honest to the rest of the world. And so when we went through our divorce, it was okay at first, but then her family got involved and it became very contentious. And it got to the point where the main contention was they were trying to take my son away and make it not just that, they were trying to make it that I would never see him again. They didn't want me to have visitation or anything. And so I had to fight that, and we had to go to court, and we actually had a trial, and we had expert witnesses and character witnesses. And all it did really essentially was wipe out every cent either of us had. And it made my son grow up very confused, and it didn't pay off for my in-laws, because eventually he resented them for trying to take him away from me. And eventually he was allowed to be in my life, which is a blessing. And ironically, he turned out to be gay too. So there's a lot more to that story. And while we're on the subject of books, I'm not trying to plug anything, but
you're an author, plug away.
My book Unraveling, which came out about a year ago, is really about that time of like accepting that the young man in that book, who's really a model for me, who's modeled on me, Randy, you know, begins to separate from his wife and starts to accept himself as a gay man. It's all about, a lot of it is autobiographical. So if someone wants to know more about my coming out and how it all worked with a family and everything, that book really, I think, dramatizes it.
This isn't a self-help show, but I want to see if our experiences were similar. I also kept telling myself I wasn't gay. I loved her too. But I believed as long as it was just sex, then it was something I was going to overcome. And what made a difference to me was a friend came into town that was gay and took me out to gay bars. And for a weekend, I just was who I am. And I realized I could never go back.
Yeah. And it's not just sex. I think I probably could have stayed married if it was just sex, but there's an emotional need you have. I think that's what I was so starved for, because I could find sexual outlets, but to find real emotional connection, that was something I'd never experienced. And it became more and more imperative that I experience that. So I think that was important. And I think people like my son, who was accepted in high school for being gay, and you know, I think he had a little bit of an easier time of it just because of his generation is much more accepting. I could have never been out in high school. I could have never been, you know, I wouldn't have been accepted. I would have been beaten to a pulp, probably. I had to hide. He didn't have to hide as much. But I think it's a, you know, it's all good. You know, my ex-wife and I got over all the drama and everything that went down when we got divorced. And now we're still friends and we're still close and we still love each other, which I'm so grateful for.
That's great. And I feel the same way that you feel about with your son. I was asked to speak to our local Gay Straight Alliance at the high school. And I had tears in my eyes because I never would have imagined such a thing in my high school.
Oh, yeah. My high school was a small town high school, so it was even probably more compounded, you know, and no one knew who I was. And the irony of it is that people probably did know, and I was bullied and teased, and I think that made me resist it even more, because I was a, you know, quiet young man who liked books more than sports, who stayed home a lot, who took care of his little sister. You know, I wasn't a very macho boy. and people teased me about that. And I think it just made me want to try harder to be like everyone else. And I wasn't. And I think it's important. And I'm loving seeing now that younger people are much more able to embrace who they are in a public way, with acceptance and love from other people. We're certainly not there yet, but it's certainly a lot better. And I've seen a lot of progress in my lifetime for acceptance. And I never thought I'd even be married to a man. And, you know, we've been together going on 20 years now. So.
Well, it sounds like it's working.
Yeah.
You were talking about the Dahmer book, The Man from Milwaukee, and that it originally was going to be a horror novel, and it did get elements of love. And I find it interesting, your writing is across the board. You've done romance, you've done horror, shifters, werewolves, which I guess are really shifters. You've done erotica, you've done literary works, thrillers. Since 2007, when you started really writing much more, and most of them, but not all, were romance, have you found that you're putting that romance or love in all elements of your stories, including the horror stories?
Yes, I would say yes. It's such a universal emotion, I think, need we all have for this to have a connection with someone or others in our lives. And so it, you know, even in the darkest stories, it plays a part, because it's the antidote, especially in the darkest stories, because love is the antidote to the darkness. It's the light. I'm getting very philosophical.
Unfortunately, we're coming to the end of the show. So my listeners begged me to bring this back. It's called Awkward Questions Authors Get. And what I do is I spin the wheel. I asked a lot of authors strange questions or questions that are uncomfortable to them. And I will draw one.
Okay.
And we'll see what you get. So hold still while I spin the wheel. Okay.
Wow, that's a long spin.
And it's a really big wheel. That's why it's so loud.
That's what they all say.
So here's your question.
Okay.
How do you justify the cost of your books when so many are only 99 cents?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I mean, I have some 99-cent reads out there, and my latest book is only $4.99. I think as much as a writer, I can answer that as a reader. I mean, what you're getting for even for the highest prices of books, you know, say you pay $20 for a book, that book will keep you company, will keep you entertained, may make a difference in your life, may make you laugh, may make you cry. They make you think, and it's the cost of probably less than you pay to go out to dinner or for two movie tickets if you go out with a friend or a significant other or family member. And I love movies, I love plays, but those kind of things are fleeting. But a book you will always have, you can read it again, you can read it again and again and again. And it's something that might change your life. It's an experience that you share with an author. Not only share, you're not just an audience when you read a book. It's probably the most emotional and mental connection of many art forms, because you conspire with an author to bring that book and that story to life. You see those characters, you cast that book in your head as you're reading it, and you see those characters in your mind if the writer does his job. So I think even the most expensive books are great values. So I think whatever the cost is, if it's a book you've really enjoyed and you really love, it's a good value no matter what the price.
I would think I could add on to that, but actually you said it so beautifully. I'm going to leave it alone. Well said.
That wasn't too hard.
No, that wasn't too hard. I got to thank you very much for being on the show.
And well, thank you for having me. And this went much faster than I expected it to go, because I'm a total introvert. I always kind of get nervous about doing these things. And here we are at the end of the interview, and it just zipped by, and I enjoyed myself. So thank you for making my Sunday afternoon brighter.
Wonderful. Well, you sound very relaxed to me. Be sure to subscribe to Queer Writers of Crime wherever you hear our show. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.